had pre-existing files on the whole thing, which were used for the composition of the plot. So the designated culprit picked out in advance, and I think I already mentioned that there's an increase of file activity on Oswald just before the assassination, and there is an increase of file activity on the alleged hijackers just before 9/11. So I think that's a very important similarity.
Let's go a step further, Peter Dale Scott. The entire creation of the official commissions, the Warren Commission, the so-called 9/11 Commission, the commissions are designed to create or craft and then propagate an official narrative. There's a whole sort of other, what you might call deep politic or deep politic-like events underneath that, that attacks anybody that challenges the official narratives as conspiracy theorists. And of course, the CIA hatched that to attack J. Edward Epstein and through their Mockingbird agents in journalism and
they
so
had,
on.
They had a whole, by 1966, a series of directives of how to discredit critic of the Warren Report.
Just to underline that point, because it assumes a new importance when we think about Mark Gordon's suggestion that the JFK assassination cabal has more or less owned the commercially controlled media for decades. Could it be that the original intent, countering criticism of the Warren Report, was quickly generalized by a cabal intent on committing crimes left, right and center, but which controlled the official bodies who gave an analysis of what happened, to this is how you can undermine anybody who criticizes the official narrative? This is from episode 561, $100 million to crack a lone nut. We're going to have a few minutes by Mark Crispin Miller on that particular declassified CIA memo. He was speaking in the run-up to the Reinvestigate Building 7 conference in 2011.
I think it's abundantly clear that the NIST study leaves a lot to be desired, and that there's copious and specific evidence that the official explanation for 9/11 in general, and Building 7 in particular, it strains credulity. But the question is, how come when there's so much evidence that cries out for a new investigation, which after all is what we want, how come when there's so much evidence, there seems to be no journalistic response? There's no reporting on this important story. In fact, the more evidence there is, it seems, the less likely any kind of coverage, the more resistant journalists tend to become, and that's not just mainstream journalists, but even on the left as well. Well, there's nothing really particularly unusual about this problem. In other words, the journalistic silence on the vast body of evidence vis-a-vis Building 7, for example, is not unusual. It's something that we've seen repeatedly over the last 50 or 60 years. The reason why you get no journalistic hearing despite all that evidence is that this notion that the official report is faulty is a conspiracy theory, right? And you are all conspiracy theorists, and you've heard a lot of conspiracy theory here. That's the phrase you run into again and again and again and again. So this is the problem that the panel's going to discuss, and I'm going to introduce the other panelists as soon as I make just a couple of very basic points, and they don't require any background in engineering, okay? I think the engineers here will enjoy them, however, or appreciate them, I should say. First of all, the idea that there might be some kind of an elite conspiracy was once upon a time in this nation's history a given. I mean, if you read widely in the work of the framers, you see that the possibility that their young Republican experiment might be undone by an elite conspiracy. It was always on their minds. They were preoccupied with this, that the British Empire and its agents and its sympathizers in the United States might do everything they could conspiratorially to destroy this experiment in Republican self-government. This is, you know, just read what they had to say about Aaron Burr, for example. Elite conspiracy was not a crackpot idea, but common sense. So it's important to understand that, that this allergy that we have all developed to anything that smacks of conspiracy theory, where we make the sign of the cross and hold ourselves away, you know, this is fairly recent. And it is particularly germane, I think, to note that it was not commonplace in journalistic discourse until the late 60s. It was not until some authors began to question the findings of the Warren Commission that journalists began to use the phrase conspiracy theory. I should say that the phrase conspiracy theory became current, and it really never stopped being current. We've seen it repeatedly ever since, particularly from 1980 on. And I can suggest that you dig up a declassified CIA memo from April 1st, 1967 that deals with the problem of these authors. This is Mark Lane and Edward J. Epstein had written books questioning the results of the Warren Commission. The CIA said, this is a problem. Our solution is to use our, this is a quote, propaganda assets and friends in the media to discredit the work of these conspiracy theorists by using the following five arguments. You know, and then there are arguments we keep hearing today, like if there were such a big conspiracy, someone would have talked, something like that. The point is that there it is, it's in black and white, it's the CIA suggesting that the media be used to cast aspersions on what were, after all, entirely reasonable questions about the official explanation of the Kennedy assassination. Okay? Well, if you search the phrase conspiracy theory in the archives of the New York Times or Time magazine, it'll take you a few seconds, you see that before the late 60s, the phrase was very, very rarely used. And then after the late 60s, it's used again and again and again and again. I would suggest that if you want to get anywhere with this issue, okay, you cannot keep simply trying to push the evidence on journalists. At the same time, you have to raise a more fundamental question, which is, what do we mean when we say something's a conspiracy theory? And why is it self-evident that conspiracies are impossible? Conspiracies against democracy. Why are they any more unlikely now than they were back in 1787? So the fact is, there have been many stories since the 60s that have been treated in exactly this way, stories in which the evidence is overwhelming, which the case has actually been made, and yet somehow that story gets dismissed as a conspiracy theory. I don't need to see the evidence. I know it's conspiracy theory because it's unlikely, because it's something I'd rather not believe.
It's not so scandalous that two commissions were appointed, one after each event. What is a scandal is that the wrong people were appointed to head them. The role of Alan Dulles as being the chief man directing activities on the Warren Commission staff when, as I said earlier in this broadcast, he had just been fired by J.F. Kennedy, and there was a real tension, huge tension between Kennedy and the CIA. It shows how docile the press is that there was no press criticism of this.
Amazingly, Kissinger, when he was the first draft for Bush's 9/11 commission, and the Bush administration, by the way, as you well know, you could call it foot dragging, took over 400 days to get around to appointing a commission after 9/11. And then they appoint Henry Kissinger. I mean, that's an incredible.
They tried to, yes. Right. And I would point to the man that ended up being a co-chairman, Lee Hamilton. Lee Hamilton, I don't want to make him sound as if he's a murderous villain, but he is a professional cover-upper, you might almost say a designated cover-upper. And I have, in 1991, I did a book called Cocaine Politics, and from personal experience described how he was part of an elaborate conspiracy, that's the only word for it, to create a false impression that the Contras in the Iran-Contra scandal, the troops in, if that's what you want to call them, the irregular forces in Nicaragua that were being backed by America, to show that they had nothing to do with drugs. Well, they had everything to do with drugs. It was a false claim, and it had to be supported by false evidence, and Lee Hamilton played a role in contriving a false report to suggest that they had nothing to do with drugs, which was 180 degrees wrong in that case. So, yes, it's not the coincidence that there are two commissions, but that people who shouldn't have been appointed to run the commission are appointed to run the commission. And, of course, I would say particularly the director of the 9/11 commission was a man. He had done a book with Condoleezza Rice. He was part...
Philip Zelikow.
The whole idea was to have a commission that had nothing to do with government. You look at the staff... Almost all of them came out of the Justice Department, FBI, CIA. It was a pseudo non-government.
And Project commission. For New American Century, a lot of those people were involved.
Right. The wrong people. That's what makes it.
Well, the right people if you're looking for a cover-up.
Yes, right, right, exactly.
Well, we only have a few minutes left in this segment, so we wanted to maybe get back to some of your thoughts on JFK on the 50th anniversary of the assassination. We certainly know there were a lot of problems with the Warren Commission report, falsifications, evidence that was never submitted. As you said, sort of the official theory and the official idea, the official narrative was already floated before the investigation even started, similar to 9/11. You know, we had all these mm-hmm. kind of major problems. But where are you now, Peter Dale Scott, 50 years later? Where are you now in your mind on JFK? What could you share with people on what do you think really happened?
Well, first of all, I want to freely acknowledge to my friends like Noam Chomsky. He was elected as a hawk, no question. He promised he was elected with the help of the so-called missile gap, with the phony fear that we were way behind the Soviets when it came to missiles, when in fact we were ahead. And I think the Soviets had four functioning missiles into ICBMs or something. He was elected as a hawk. And this is pretty, many, many people would say this. The missile crisis frightened him, and it also frightened Khrushchev. And these two men understood that there had to be a change. And I think not one, but two different speeches given by Kennedy in June of 63 define changes in the man that helped doom him. The first one, which has often been commented on, was his June 10th American University speech, where he said, "We are all mortal, and we have to come to terms with the Soviet Union." The very next day, I think the news from Birmingham and the use of hoses on small children and dogs on small children, and Kennedy, I think without much planning. Both of these speeches, by the way, didn't go through the bureaucracy. He had to do them outside. The second one, I think, was done very quickly, was the speech that we have to have a Civil Rights Act and end this torment in the South. And that developed a kind of coalition. Most people don't know that when Kennedy was killed, there was celebration all through the South. It was they loved it, just the way that some people. I don't have time for this in this program. But when the towers went down in 9/11, there were people who celebrated not just in Pakistan, but in New Jersey. So there's something to investigate there. But the common denominator, I think, is the intelligence networks and the military, because you had a very high representation of unreconstructed Southerners in both of those places, particularly in the military, and high-level groups. I can't call the names to mind. They were very small, very marginal, but they were very extreme, who were talking in March of 63 about how to get rid of traitorous leaders. And you find Southerners who were also ex-military leading those things, the Black Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, who went on a killing spree after 1963, killed so many civil rights leaders. They were not marginal loners. They were people who fit into the deep sort of infrastructure of our country, partly because of their connections in the military.
When we look at the Kennedy assassination and the Warren Commission coming out with a lone gunman, isolated individual, does it by himself approach, but there were other layers to that, and that was that Oswald had been reported to have been in Mexico City,
yes.
Which is debated whether or not. In fact, that the CIA section chief there was a fellow named David Phillips, apparently, who was also in Dallas the day of the assassination.
Well, I don't want to attest to saying he was in Dallas. Almost everybody's been accused of being in Dallas. Howard Hunt was supposed
exactly,
to have been there.
If you read these George materials.
Walker Bush.
The first part of your statement is absolutely true, that he was there. And there was, of course, I don't want to get too technical here, but what really affected the way that the assassination was treated by Lyndon Johnson afterwards was the news coming out of Mexico that Oswald had been in touch with the Soviet embassy there. And I personally do not believe it was the man we think was Oswald. In fact, there's a one message that somebody who listened to the tape of the man who was claiming to be Oswald, everyone says he spoke very bad Russian. Oswald's Russian was not all that bad, but also he spoke very broken English. Well, if he spoke broken English, well, that's a pretty good prima facie argument that it wasn't our Lee Harvey Oswald. All of this, I think, I do think that what happened in Mexico was done with the assassination in mind, and it had the effect of creating what I call a phase one approach to the assassination and a phase two. Phase one approach is this involves Cuba or it involves Russia, and there are still people to this day, and they have CIA connections, who say that Castro did it or that Khrushchev did it. Both of these were insane. You know, I mean, the last thing, that's like Bashar wanting to use chemical weapons. Castro killing Kennedy was signing his death warrant. So what happens almost immediately after this phase one version, and there's, by the way, evidence for it, most of which got suppressed, but now has surfaced, and we see, oh, yes, they really did have some pretty good reasons to think that Castro did it. And now you move very quickly to the phase two approach is, we don't want to have a war, and I'm quoting Johnson now talking to Warren, persuading him to go on the commission, which he very much didn't want to do. We don't want to have a war in which millions of people die in a nuclear holocaust. So phase two is it was a lone nut. And nobody really believes it was a lone nut, but a lot of people are willing to go along with the lone nut thing because they don't want the false story that Castro did it to occupy the airwaves and get America involved in an unnecessary war against Cuba or worse still, the Soviet Union.
Now, we return to Mark Gorton looking at another way in which fear is used to persuade people to acquiesce to the official narrative. Post-9/11 death squads. In addition to the congressional cover-ups, the media censorship, and the active disinformation campaign, the cabal behind the 9/11 attacks has been systematically killing key witnesses, journalists, and anybody capable of getting a government inquiry into the 9/11 attacks started. These deaths include witnesses who saw various aspects of the 9/11 op, like Catherine Smith, a Tennessee DMV employee who sold IDs to five of the hijackers. In February 2002, a day before Catherine was supposed to testify in court about her actions, She was firebombed in her car and killed. Dr. David Graham, the Shreveport, Louisiana dentist who saw three of the 9/11 hijackers with a Pakistani business, was poisoned in September 2006. Barry Jennings, who was witness to early explosions within World Trade Center 7, was killed in August 2008. Kenneth Yohannemann, who was a witness to explosions in the basement of World Trade Center 1 prior to the plane strikes, was killed by a gunshot wound to the head in September 2008. Bertha Champagne, the longtime babysitter for Marvin Bush, was crushed by a car in Marvin Bush's driveway. Journalists who got too close to the truth also suffered a terrible fate. Hunter S. Thompson was working on a major story about the World Trade Center towers being brought down by explosives when he was murdered on February the 19th, 2005. Philip Marshall was a retired airline pilot with over 20,000 hours of experience flying Boeing jets. He wrote two clear, concise books outlining the 9/11 op. He was shot along with his two children on February the 1st, 2013. The Bush Syndicate has recognized governmental legal proceedings as a threat and has been working to systematically kill anyone who could have gotten a court case or government investigation going. Beverly Eckert was a 9/11 widow who chose to sue for justice rather than accept the $1.8 million payment for the death of her husband. She wrote in a moving editorial that is worth reading, quote, "I say to Congress, big business, and everyone who conspired to divert attention from government and private sector failures, my husband's life was priceless, and I will not let his death be meaningless. My silence cannot be bought." Unquote. Beverly Eckert was killed in a plane crash. Most likely, this crash was one in a long line of plane crashes used to kill high-profile threats to the criminal syndicate at the heart of the national security state. Michael Doran was a lawyer working with families on 9/11 victims on a variety of lawsuits, and he also flew small airplanes. On April 29, 2009, Michael was killed when his plane crashed. Prior to the crash, Michael had reported multiple incidents of his plane being sabotaged. The criminal forces within the national security state have a long history of killing many people for the purposes of hiding the death of one key, high-profile individual. Major General David Worley and his wife Anne were claimed to be among the victims of the Washington, D.C. metro crash in June 2009. Seven other people were killed in this crash. General Worley would have been a key witness to the high-level orders issued on 9/11 regarding the air defenses over D.C. The above list of people is just an abbreviated list. In many cases, it's hard to know if a person was murdered. But in any case, active, professional, highly organized death squads are out killing innocent Americans who pose a threat to the criminal syndicate buried within the federal government. Now, there's empty sections about 9/11 as part of a comprehensive coup, 15 years in the making, the New World Order, an almost empty section on the George W. Bush administration. Obama. The popular myth about Barack Obama is that he was a charismatic community organizer who rose to political prominence based upon his natural abilities. However, a deeper look shows Obama to have been groomed from the time he was in college by members of the power elite. My reading of the situation is that he was recruited as a CIA asset while a student at Occidental. His family had been in the orbit of CIA operations since before Barack was born. Obama transferred from Occidental to Columbia University during his junior year in college. His time at Columbia is cloaked in mystery. Wayne Allen Root was, like Obama, a political science major at Columbia, who also graduated in 1983. In 2008, Root said of Obama, quote, "I don't know a single person at Columbia that knew him, and they all know me. I don't have a classmate who ever knew Barack Obama at Columbia. Ever. Nobody recalls him. I'm not exaggerating. I'm not kidding." Unquote. according to Professor Henry Graf, quote, "I don't consider him a Columbia student. I have no idea what he did on the Columbia campus. No one knows him," unquote. In an age where the college records of presidential candidates are generally released to the public, Barack Obama stands alone in keeping his college records sealed. In June of 1981, right after moving to New York City, with almost no money, Obama was able to travel to Indonesia and Pakistan, despite Pakistan being on the State Department's no-travel list in 1981. In Pakistan, Obama went on a partridge hunting trip with Mohammed Sumro, who would go on to become acting president of Pakistan in 2008. At Columbia, Obama wrote his thesis on arms reduction negotiations between the U.S. and the USSR. U.S.-Soviet relations were the speciality of Columbia faculty member, Trilateral Commission founder, and Obama policy advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski. Immediately after college, Obama took a job in New York with Business International Corporation, which served as a CIA front in various operations around the globe. After 2 years there, Obama moved to Chicago and began work as a community organizer. While working as a community organizer, Obama applied to Harvard Law School. However, Obama was not just another law school applicant. He had help from a network of wealthy, powerful people. Khalid al-Mansour was the principal advisor to one of the world's richest men, Saudi Prince al-Wahid bin Talal. In 1987, al-Mansour approached prominent black leader and former Manhattan Borough president, Percy Sutton, and asked him to write a recommendation to his friends at Harvard Law School on Obama's behalf. At Harvard Law School, Obama was selected to the prestigious role of president of the Law Review. After law school, Obama moved back to Chicago, where he took a job as a lecturer at the University of Chicago Law School. According to Doug Ross, Obama applied for a teaching position at the University of Chicago Law School and was rejected. But a few weeks later, the Board of Trustees called the law school and told them to put Obama on the faculty. Obama then used the University of Chicago position as a platform for a future career. Despite not having accomplished anything in his life more significant than attending prestigious schools, Obama used the faculty position to write his memoir, Dreams of My Father. The University of Chicago boasts the highest output of published papers per professor of any law school in the country. However, in 12 years on the faculty, Obama did not publish a single journal article. While in Chicago, Obama cultivated powerful friends, such as Penny Pritzker, and a network of Chicago's elite. While running for U.S. Senate in 2004, Obama benefited from aggressive reporting from the Chicago Tribune that targeted first his primary opponent Blair Hull, and then Republican nominee Jack Ryan, who was destroyed when, in a highly unusual move, a Los Angeles judge granted a request by the Chicago Tribune to unseal Ryan's divorce records, despite both Ryan and his ex-wife Jerry Ryan's wishes that the records be kept sealed. The records contained a claim by Jack that suggested Jerry have sex with him in public at a swingers club. This revelation undermined Ryan's campaign, and he withdrew from the race. While he was still just a candidate for Senate, Obama was selected to give the keynote address at the Democratic National Convention in 2004. Obama's speech rocketed him to national prominence. By the time the 2008 presidential election rolled around, Obama had become the favorite Democratic candidate of the power elite. With the remarkable uniformity that is evidence of a massive intelligence propaganda campaign, the controlled corporate media backed Obama heavily and pummeled Senator Clinton. Obama went on to victory in November, with talk of hope and change. Obama's administration has proven to be a great disappointment for most Obama supporters. Instead of delivering change, Obama has continued most of the worst of the policies of the Bush administration. The Patriot Act has been renewed. Government secrecy has been taken to new levels. Obama has conducted a war on whistleblowers who seek to improve the government. The U.S. military is active in more countries, and so on and so on. Obama can be seen as a right-wing spy within the cover of a liberal Democrat. This characterization correctly fits all available information about Obama's background, and it also fits with the policy positions that Obama has taken. Using this analysis, back in March 2008, Webster Tarpley was able to correctly predict Obama's behavior in office by analyzing the policies of Obama advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski. Tarpley was able to predict that Obama would pivot from trying to start a war with Iran to the more dangerous approach of militarily provoking Russia.
We wanted to shift our focus to talk a little bit more about what you mean by COG, or continuity of government.
Yes, that's my most recent books. Road to 9/11 I talked about for the first time. Continuity of government, by the way, is not my term. It is a state-of-the-art government term for emergency planning, which has gone on off and on since the 1950s, but it took a new turn under Reagan. Reagan appointed a committee with people outside government to plan what was accurately called, when it was first exposed, plans for the suspension of the U.S. Constitution. Well, that tells you something about this country, that a president can appoint a committee of men not in government to plan for the suspension of the Constitution. Well, the justification was, well, it's only for an atomic attack where, you know, you might have the president and the vice president and Congress all killed, so you have to have a backup plan. But they changed that under Reagan, so it wasn't just planning for an atomic attack, but for any emergency. And the proof that it was changed, I mean, I actually quote the executive order that changed it, but most people don't know this. Continuity of government measures were actually implemented on 9/11. And the 9/11 Commission report acknowledges this twice. And then in a footnote says, we chose not to go into it, which means we chose not to do our job, because I believe it's no coincidence that the men who implemented it on 9/11, which were Cheney and Rumsfeld, were the men who had been planning it for 20 years with other people, James Woolsey. We know a few of the other names. And what is most remarkable is in the late 90s, when Clinton was not very keen on all of this, and according to one author, barely knew what was going on, but you had two CEOs who were not in the government planning for suspension of the Constitution. They were Cheney, who was the CEO of Halliburton, which was all involved with oil in Central Asia, where the troops were sent because of 9/11, and also Rumsfeld, who was CEO of a drug company. They were planning suspension of the Constitution. And then there has, since then, both before and after, but particularly after 9/11, a huge expansion of contracted out intelligence security activities. It's multi-billion budget. Even COG planning itself, to give you an idea of how big it was before 9/11, it was, I think, $8 billion just to construct an alternative communications network outside the government network. I believe that COG network outside the government was the key to 9/11 and the key also to JFK. And that's something that I didn't know when I made a comparison of it. I didn't know that people who were part of the COG planning were sent to Washington just before the JFK assassination to deal with the events. I'm talking about one man, but he has just gone public in the last couple of months. He was supposed to go to Dallas. They said, no, no, we need you in Washington. Why did they need him in Washington? I've said for years that the White House Communications Agency was part of the conspiracy, because they were an extra channel in Dallas. The Secret Service were using their own channel, which was never written up in the Warren report, and I think that's where the false description of the assassin, which matched Oswald's FBI file, I think it came from there. It was part of the emergency communications networks. I think most people know now that there are hollowed out mountains near Washington. That's all COG planning. And I think it's not irrelevant that Cheney, right after 9/11, he went and spent 90 days on a hollowed out mountain with 100 top people. Where did the Patriot Act come from? A 364-page document that Congress had 48 hours to read, and I think there were only two copies for them to read it. That was like the Tonkin Gulf Resolution. It had to have been prepared in advance of the event, and I'm quite convinced you'll find that it has its origins in COG planning. So it's big, it's multi-budget. I have a whole chapter in American War Machine on this. They, in effect, design their own budgets. Well, you know, all power corrupts, but unchecked power, absolute power, corrupts absolutely. And these budgets have been expanding enormously, and there's been huge mission creep. That's why what we're hearing now about NSA sort of monitoring just about everybody, that's what happens to these unchecked agencies. And so many people have said that there is now, in effect, a second government without constitutional restraint. This is not just me. I mean, Dana Priest has said it, CNN said it, even Stephen Emerson, who's not a man I agree with very often, said it. It's true. We have a whole second level of government that isn't being restrained by the checks and balances that were set up by the Constitution.
Bill Moyers called it a secret government 25 years ago.
Oh, right, yeah.
So this is a long time, this going on.
It's been building and building and building, yes.
George H.W. Bush as the mastermind of the 9/11 op. I have seen no evidence linking George H.W. Bush directly to the 9/11 attacks. But just as physicists can detect the presence of a black hole by the actions of other bodies around it, so the massive force of George H.W. Bush in the 9/11 op can be inferred. Many people extremely close to Bobby Bush were actively involved in the 9/11 op, including his oldest son, George W. Bush, his youngest son, Marvin Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Prince Bandar, the Iran-Contra Network, the BCCI Network. On September the 10th, 2001, George H.W. Bush was in Washington, D.C., where he attended the investor conference of the Carlyle Group, along with Osama bin Laden's brother, Shafiq bin Laden. Poppy Bush then spent the night of September the 10th at the White House, despite the fact that his son was in Florida. Poppy Bush was a master spy. He'd been at the heart of the CIA his entire career. In honor of his crucial role at the core of the CIA, the CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, is now named the George Bush Center for Intelligence. As a protege of Alan Dulles, Bush learned the tradecraft that kept him in the shadows and his crimes hard to detect. During his tenure as vice president under Reagan, Poppy Bush was head of the secret government apparatus. The networks of people involved in the 9/11 operation line up perfectly with Poppy Bush's own networks. The CIA, Saudi leadership, Saudi intelligence, Pakistani ISI, etc. These are the same networks that had been involved with Poppy Bush's previous criminal acts. The CIA Republican Counter-Surprise, Iran-Contra, BCCI, and Poppy Bush had been the prime mover in all of these operations. Whoever conceived the 9/11 attacks had to be a heartless killer. For years, Poppy Bush had been authorizing the killings of hundreds of innocent Americans to cover up his earlier crimes. From the early 1970s to the present day, Poppy Bush has owned the responsibility for covering up JFK's assassination, including the killing of many dozens of people. 400 were killed, to cover up the Enterprise Iran-Contra alone. Whoever planned the 9/11 op had to have the boldness to think that a massive crime could be committed in broad daylight. Most people could not even imagine daring to get away with such a crime, but Poppy Bush had decades of experience getting away with bold, high-profile crimes, from the coup of 63 to Watergate to the CIA Republican counter-surprise to Iran-Contra. After LBJ, Allen Dulles, and J. Edgar Hoover died, Poppy Bush assumed responsibility for the ongoing cover-up of the coup of 63. He would carry this responsibility with him for the rest of his life. He could never retire. The fear of exposure of his past crimes would haunt him every day. An outbreak of peace, a victory in the Cold War, presented a profound threat to his liberty. As head of the secret government, Poppy Bush had responsibility for ensuring that the U.S. stay on a perpetual war footing, so that the crimes of the national security state would continue to be suppressed. The original planning for the 9/11 op occurred either during Bush's tenure as vice president or during his presidential administration. During the 1980s, Bush led the secret government apparatus buried within the national security state. The secret government had been functioning for decades and had the ability to operate outside the constitutional chain of command. Much of the execution of the 9/11 op occurred within the U.S. government during the Clinton administration. Due to Clinton's complicity in the Contra drug trafficking and enterprise-related financial crimes, Clinton kept in office over 1,000 Bush appointees who helped keep these crimes under wraps. This same network of people played a crucial role in enabling 9/11 to happen, and this network was loyal to Poppy Bush. The 9/11 op needed to have a sympathetic president in the U.S. in order to make it work. In this sense, 9/11 was a gift from father to son. Few other people could conceivably count on a future president being supportive of such a heinous crime. Poppy Bush operations worked on many levels and served many purposes. The 9/11 op has the hallmarks of a Poppy Bush operation. 9/11 helped create a permanent war on terror that has served as a justification for two imperialistic wars. It also enabled the Patriot Act and its massive expansion of government secrecy, which helps keep old crimes buried. 9/11 helped destroy a large number of criminal and civil investigations which would have led to the Bush Syndicate, and 9/11 justified a surge in military intelligence spending, much of which went into the pockets of Bush allies. In addition, many different types of financial crimes, insider trading, insurance fraud, money laundering, financial looting, were embedded within the plot. The 9/11 attacks as pretext to destroy criminal investigations. Destroying World Trade Center 7 had no public relations purpose for the Bush Syndicate. At 47 stories, most people were not even aware that it existed. Yet within World Trade Center 7 were many government offices, including the FBI, the CIA, the SEC, the Justice Department, and the Secret Service. World Trade Center 7 was also the storage facility for millions of files pertaining to active cases involving international drug dealing, organized crime, terrorism, and money laundering. By destroying World Trade Center 7, the Bush Syndicate was able to stop many criminal investigations that would have led to high-level members of the criminal cabal embedded within the U.S. government. The need to avoid prosecution for previous crimes may have been one of the largest motivations for the 9/11 attacks. These investigations included World Trade Center Building 6, which housed the U.S. Customs Agency, and the El Dorado Task Force, an interagency group founded in 1992, which coordinated all major money laundering investigations in the U.S. An FBI investigation into gold price fixing and gold laundering, housed on the 22nd floor on the North Tower in the World Trade Center. an FBI case against Mobil Oil and James Giffen on illegal oil swaps between Iran and Kazakhstan, at that time before a New York grand jury. The Bank of New York money laundering, evidence in Buildings 1 and 7. Three agencies involved in the Enron investigation, the SEC, the Justice Department, and the FBI. In World Trade Center 7, the IRS was investigating Barrick Gold's offshore hedge book. 3,000 to 4,000 cases at the SEC office, including documents showing the relationship between Citigroup and WorldCom. Instead of flying straight over the Potomac and into the offices of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Secretary of Defense, American Airlines Flight 77 executed a very difficult 330-degree descending corkscrew to crash into the section of the Pentagon containing the Office of Naval Intelligence and Pentagon Budget Analysis. The Office of Naval Intelligence had just been moved into the section of the Pentagon which was destroyed on 9/11. At that time, the Office of Naval Intelligence was investigating a gold price fixing and gold laundering scheme that could have implicated the Bush Syndicate. Also killed in the Pentagon on 9/11 were a large number of budget analysts and accountants who may have been looking into the $2.3 trillion of unaccounted military spending that Donald Rumsfeld announced on September 10, 2001. In addition, after 9/11, many government investigators who previously had been looking into domestic government criminal activity were diverted from those cases to the newly created War on Terror, as a result of both the destruction of ongoing investigations and the diversion of resources. All investigations which threatened criminals embedded within the highest levels of the U.S. government were stopped. And that's where we're going to conclude reading Mark Gorton's essay. There's a couple more sections. He talks about explosions, the demolition of the World Trade Center towers, and has got some useful things to say on it, but it's fairly similar to stuff we're pretty familiar with on the show. If you'd like to download the whole audiobook, I shall publish it. It should be available at unwelcomeguests.net/audiobooks. Now, I've had a busy few weeks since I came across that essay. I've been attempting to document what he's been saying, following up references, investigating, and turning up bunches more stuff, which I've been putting on wikispooks.org. My greatest concern about what Gorton says is not his suggestion of what's happened, as much as his prediction that it might take another 50 years before all the dirt gets dished on 9/11. Well, I'm actually pretty persuaded that what with information flowing around the world faster than ever, like this podcast, for example, I don't actually think it's possible to stop these secrets from coming out. Now, I came across the Mark Gorton essay on a website called Gawker, which is in the top 1,000 most popular websites. So whilst it's possible to censor Wikipedia, because of Wikipedia's centralized structure, there are real difficulties in censoring the internet. Yeah, that of course is related to abandoning net neutrality and the media circus about cyber terrorism. The threat is not a threat of terrorists hacking in and undoing a nuclear power station as much as the threat of the truth being told about what is actually going on. So I'm optimistic about the future. So, as ever, I'm optimistic about the power of truth to attract people's interest and loyalty, and no amount of repetition of narrowly self-interested lies has that power to command people's respect and loyalty. And Mark Gorton himself, as a businessman, got plenty of other things to do, no actual training and background in this, but just wanted to understand what was going on in the world, and has picked up this challenge and has run with it. So to return to another common theme on the show, I'm not expecting great things from the corporate media. Even, say, The Guardian, much vaunted for their revealing of Edward Snowden's leaks, haven't actually exposed 9/11. So is this because nobody there on the staff has noticed? Well, in one sense, it doesn't actually matter why people didn't make this decision to publish. Probably a combination of many people who have been too scared to go there, others who the thought hadn't crossed their mind, others still who are on the take, a range of reasons. But the bottom line is, I think it's unrealistic to expect corporate media to tell unvarnished truths and to be honest. We have irrefutable evidence of mass surveillance. That's what this Edward Snowden leak program is about, to persuade people that they're being monitored and watched, and everything they do online is being logged and tracked, could be used against them. So if this is unconstitutional, I didn't hear anybody suggesting that it was actually constitutional, then does anybody ask who's broken the laws here? Lying under oath is actually an offence. So if nobody's asking these, I don't actually listen to corporate media, so I may be wrong on this. But what I pick up suggests to me that no, the debate is being framed, and issues about prosecuting wrongdoing by people in institutions, positions of power, so-called, do not come onto the agenda. Why would that be? Those people are members of the deep state. They're not there in a public capacity. They have other loyalties, and laws which apply to you and me, non-members of the deep state, do not apply to them. So, to return to the title of this episode, is 50 years enough? I personally would rather live without a deep state, and I don't know a lot of people who are in favour of unaccountable power, including the ability to torture people, murder people, disappear people. So here's a question from the Q&A section of last week. We didn't put any questions there, but this one struck me as particularly relevant, so I thought I'd save it for this week's episode.
Is there a place in a well-functioning democracy for secret agencies of the order of the CIA? Or put it another way, can you conceive of a way to have effective oversight over these agencies? Is it possible to open up these agencies to some kind of continuous scrutiny? Or is that simply not possible because of the nature of the necessary secretive dimension of their functioning?
Well, it's a very good question. I'm glad you asked it. And I've thought about it a great deal. And like many people, I think we have to make a distinction between the secret collection of intelligence and sharing of intelligence and covert operations. If you go back to the history of the CIA, it was created for intelligence. And then I mentioned, but didn't go into the details, but I do at some length in American War Machine. A year later, separately, you had the creation of the so-called Office of Policy Coordination, OPC. That was a covert operations agency, which is, I would say, the number one source of the terrible problems that American foreign policy has got. My whole book is a tracing of how this led to the building up, not just collaboration with, but the building up of the narcotics traffic in first Southeast Asia and then in Laos and then eventually in Afghanistan. It's all the heirs of the OPC, including a man most of you haven't heard of, Colonel Stilwell, who together with Ted Shackley, who was a disciple of one of the lead OPC people, they helped set up JSOC in what is now SOCOM. And SOCOM, I think, is more dangerous now than the CIA and is actually writing books against the CIA as being too namby-pamby, etc. I think that there is no compatibility between secret covert operations and democracy. I think there is compatibility with intelligence that goes, it's always dangerous. Anything secret is dangerous. And the trouble is that I wish that Eisenhower, in his famous warning about the military industrial complex, had said the military intelligence industrial complex, and I think he would have nailed the danger a little more precisely. Many people have said, I mean, it was the whole thrust of the Church Committee, that we have something really very dangerous here. And there have been attempts to reform it. I actually think most of the church reforms were converted into things which built up the war machine rather than restricted it. Because if you read the accounts of the secret covert war in Afghanistan in the 1980s, one of the lead persons pushing for more money than the CIA wanted was Representative Wilson, sitting on the House Intelligence Committee, which, thanks to the Church Committee, had oversight over what they were doing. And this really meant that the CIA now had a group inside, so that the Intelligence Committee represented the CIA in Congress. It didn't represent Congress in the CIA. But that's just a reflection of the realities that secret power grows and grows and grows and corrupts and corrupts. I could give you another 30 minutes on this, but I think it's time to stop.
Yes. Judge, one last quick question.
I would like only if you can tell the source of your precise and the precious information, the source that you gave us.
Very simple answer. Kevin Fenton's book, Disconnecting the Dots. And I hope it is widely read and translated into many languages. It's one of the most important books to come out on 9/11, I believe. And as I say, brought out by somebody who is British writing in Prague, and he was able to. He didn't do it alone. He's building on the work of Paul Thompson and the Terror Timeline people. He thanks Eric Larson. There's about five people. It's a testament to the efficacy of collaborative, open research shared on the Internet.
Well, I've been doing quite a lot of collaborative, open, shared research on the Internet myself lately. Documenting the War on Terror the other day, I came across the International Convention Against Forced Disappearance, which I never heard about on the corporate media, but apparently a bunch of nations got together at the UN General Assembly and said, "We think nations should not forcibly disappear their citizens. This is no longer acceptable." In December 2006, 57 countries signed it on the spot. Now, how many countries do you think in the subsequent 7.5 years managed to sign it? And it currently has less than 100 signatories. So, what kind of a nation wants to reserve the right to forcibly disappear its citizens? For some reason, the US and Canada never signed that. South Africa hasn't signed that. Saudi Arabia hasn't signed that. Australia and New Zealand didn't sign it. Russia and China didn't sign it. The UK didn't sign it. So, a lot of these nations which are leading the so-called war on terror apparently seem to think it's acceptable to forcibly disappear their own citizens. Need I say more about what the rule of law has become? Now, whilst this stuff doesn't make the commercially controlled media, it is out there, and I think there's a lot to be said for building an alternative narrative to the official story, one that has a lot less glitches and more of a connection to observable reality. So, if you'd like to take part in that, you're welcome to do so. The website on which I spend most of my time nowadays is wikispooks.org. Now, if you'd like to download any of Unwelcome Guests episodes, you can do so from our MP3 archive, unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.